Bitco is revolutionizing the way businesses connect. We're taking on your connectivity challenges and shooting our high-speed fiber internet across the country. Not just for some, but for everyone. Fiber is not a luxury, but a necessity. For business, for life, for you. And being connected is everything. So network with a Tier 1 internet provider and take your business to the next level of connectivity. Bitco.co.za. Connectivity is everything.
Running a business keeps you on your toes. Wouldn't it be great if your internet connection could keep up? Introducing Business Class Fiber from Vox. It's super fast, reliable, and highly cost-effective. You get unlimited calls to all SA destinations, and it's scalable. So no matter the size of your business, you've still got room to grow. Get connected with Business Class Fiber from Vox and see what super fast internet really means. For more information, visit vox.co.za.
Thank you for downloading the Tech Central podcast. My name is Duncan McLeod. Now, I'm at the offices of Uber Technologies in Johannesburg today for what I think is going to be a great chat with Alan Litz and Justin Spratt. Alan is head of Uber in sub-Saharan Africa, while Justin, who I've known for many years, is head of business development in the region. Gents, thanks for joining us on Tech Central. Alan, I'm going to start with you. Uber has been in the news a lot lately in South Africa, and often not because it's necessarily good news. But I want to go back to the founding of the business here. You've just celebrated your fourth anniversary in South Africa, is that right?
That's right.
How did you get involved with Uber originally and become its founding GM for the region? Did you approach them or did they approach you?
So I guess it's a good tech story in that I was doing some work with a private equity fund, and I got a message over LinkedIn from an internal Uber recruiter about this opportunity to join this company, Uber, as the general manager for Johannesburg. Had heard the name a couple of times. This was about June of 2013. But Uber wasn't a household name in the way that it is today. So did a bit of research and saw it as this really exciting opportunity to get involved with a global tech company. This was previous, before the Google investment. It was operating in about 20 or so cities around the world. It seemed to be gaining traction. It was really a unique opportunity to be part of this global tech company in my home country, so jumped at it. I did actually spend my first interview speaking to the launcher around how I didn't think Uber would work in Joburg, because I thought, why would people actually request a taxi, in inverted commas, using their smartphones? People would go directly to the drivers, or there'd be safety concerns. But I think the more I dug into the model, the more I understood the operating model of the business, I thought, well, actually, technology addresses a lot of these concerns, and this is a super exciting business to be part of. So jumped on that opportunity, and as you say, joined about 4 years ago. Over 4 years ago.
Joburg was actually one of the early cities to join Uber. You're in, what, over 500 cities around the world?
Yeah, so it's actually over 600 today.
Okay.
Joburg was the 34th city globally. It was probably about 12 or so countries at that stage. What was interesting is that Joburg was the first, or South Africa was the first country for Uber outside of the US, where we had three cities operational. So that's before Australia, before China, before India, before the UK. And it's always interesting, why did that happen? And I think it really comes down to two main reasons. First, on the rider side, there was no real alternative to car ownership in our cities. Yet now, through Uber, in 5 minutes or less, you can tap a button and get access to that safe and affordable ride. And on the driver side, unfortunately, unemployment's a reality. And Uber really provides a meaningful economic opportunity for driver partners. So I think the launch team saw that. We saw early success in Joburg and a huge opportunity to expand into Cape Town and Durban.
So how did it come about that South Africa, which is usually one of the last on the list when it comes to new technologies, was so high up? Was there an individual within Uber who was pushing the South African market? How did it happen?
So I think that the team felt that, listen, we want to be everywhere as a company. And they wanted to have a presence in Africa. And Joburg was the most obvious candidate for that. So Joburg was the first city to launch in Africa, and we've seen huge success since then. We're now in over 16 cities on the continent. But Joburg was that obvious choice, good investment climate here, really ease of doing business, a lot of factors which point to a global market on the African continent.
Okay. And prior to Uber, you were in investment banking. You had a career of some years at Investec, and you studied, I believe, actuarial science.
Studied actuarial science, probably just because I wasn't really sure what I wanted to study. And someone said, actuaries are, that's a good profession. Actuaries seem to do quite well, so went down that route. When I was studying actuarial science, I realized that I didn't really love this technical world, wanted something more tangible, something more real world. So I did honors in maths of finance with a hope of finding something a little bit more practical. Found that also quite a technical degree, but was lucky to join Investec as part of the graduate recruitment program. Joined the capital markets team where I was part of the lending business in capital markets, rotating through the different lending divisions. And from there, I joined the leverage finance team who were focused on giving debt to big corporates and to private equity funds. And what I loved about my time at Investec, first of all, the environment was great, a lot of opportunity for people regardless of your level. And secondly, I just got exposure to a wide range of businesses. And obviously, if you're going to lend money to a company, you need to have some sense for how that company operates. And obviously, it's quite a theoretical sense, but it was really a fantastic way for me to build a foundation and an understanding of business. I also, from there, went on to study my MBA. It was something that I always wanted to do. And while I was studying my MBA, I thought that I wanted to do something entrepreneurial. Unfortunately, didn't have any great ideas myself, but had this thought in my mind that it would be fantastic to join an early stage company, mm-hmm. and did some work with an early stage company as one of my electives during the MBA, and came back to South Africa with that in mind. And going back to the earlier part of the conversation, when Uber came about, it was really this unique opportunity to be part of an early stage company, strong investors behind the business, a brand and a business model I believed in to help grow in my home country.
Okay. So you started at Uber as general manager for South Africa. You launched Joburg. You then went into other cities. But about 2 years after joining Uber, you were appointed as the general manager for the whole sub-Saharan Africa region. How many countries and how many cities does Uber operate in the subcontinent now?
Yeah, so I actually joined as general manager for Joburg and then grew from there.
From there, okay.
So we're now in 6 countries on the continent. We launched our 13th city, being Kumasi in Ghana about a month or so ago. Was there about a month ago. Really great city. Ghana's been a fantastic country for us with first Accra, now Kumasi. So we're obviously in South Africa. That was followed by launch in Nigeria in June of 2014, and then Kenya in Jan of 2015. And then last year, in June of last year, we took on the challenge of launching 3 new countries in 3 weeks. So we kicked that off with Uganda, followed by Ghana, then finally ended off with Dar in Tanzania.
Okay. We're going to talk more about that expansion a bit later in the podcast. But Justin, you've been with the business for just over a year now.
Yeah, that's right.
Before that, of course, you were with the digital agency Quirk. Yes. And before that at Internet Solutions, which is where I first met you.
Yeah.
You're originally from Australia, in case anyone hasn't figured that out yet. But you immigrated to South Africa back in the mid-90s.
Yes.
And you seem to go against the flow of traffic. Most of the traffic seems to be going from South Africa to Australia, but you were coming the other way. Yeah. What attracted you to Uber, and has it been all you expected?
For me, I mean, I've been a huge fan of Uber from early on. I think the story is remarkable. I'm into the Silicon Valley startup world, mm-hmm. as you know, and I think as I learned more about the business, I realized the kind of step change it can bring to macroeconomics across the world, actually, because it opens up a whole bunch of economic opportunities, not just on the driver side, but also on the rider side. So because the economics of the ride is over time, increasingly lower, it allows people to get across cities and pick up economic opportunities and even entertainment opportunities that they otherwise wouldn't have had. And that, I feel, is a multiplier to the macroeconomics of countries and especially cities. And there's a few Harvard research reports that says that urban mobility and personal transport as one of the bigger unlockers to economic growth and escaping poverty. And so, you know, after being in an ad agency, I felt like I needed to do something a little bit more meaningful. Mm-hmm. with all due respect to my former colleagues, I think there's a good story there. But I wanted to do something that was more impactful. I had a good time at Quirk. I was meant to run the software businesses. So the segue from Internet Solutions was running our software portfolio at Quirk. And then Rob Stokes and our chairman, Mark Sherrington, asked me to kind of run this agency thing because it was growing so fast, we needed more heads. And so I kind of, diverted my career path into agency. It was a great journey, but it was good for me to get back. And so Uber is, you know, I'm passionate about this business. It's important for me to wake up and do something that I think is really important and work with smart people. And Elon has built an incredible business here over the 4 years. Every single one of these people are not only smart, but they really care. And that's special. You know, look, we have our trials and tribulations. I'm sure you're going to ask us a little bit about that. But at the core, this business, certainly in sub-Saharan Africa, where I work with Elon, is at its core fundamentally good, and everyone's driven to do better. That's like, you know, I'm extremely fortunate to have got this job. I've been lucky in my career, but this is a role that it's amazing, and it's phenomenal to have a job in a company I had a crush on, and live and do things that are meaningful. So extremely fortunate.
You had a very entrepreneurial role when you were at Internet Solutions. You launched a number of new products and businesses there, took challenged some of the bigger operators with some of those products. Mm. And you've come back into an entrepreneurial type of role here, right?
Yeah, look, I started out at Morgan Stanley and in fixed income trading, and that was quite swashbuckling, and you didn't have to follow the rules too much. So that was a good fit. But then I realized, you know, investment banking doesn't actually really contribute much to society, and I actually don't mind saying that. So then I segued into my other passion, which was tech. Internet Solutions under Angus McRobert was phenomenal. He gave us a long leash, as long as we kind of brought in the results, a very entrepreneurial environment. Then Rob Stokes brought me in a Quirk, very entrepreneurial, didn't have to follow the rules. We had to kind of, you know, make and break the rules. And then I think, Travis Kalanick at Uber deserves a lot of credit. He's created a business that was allowed, you know, that allowed its people to be extremely entrepreneurial. You know, we're now 632 cities within 7 years. That's just incredible on so many levels. And so these launches and the GMs had a high degree of trust. And invariably, these guys have delivered. You know, young MBA grads that have a passion for doing good have done a remarkable job. So for me, it's kind of entrepreneurial. I'm not really going to fit in a big corporate. All my managers have told me I'm very difficult to manage. So it's kind of almost not by choice. I have to do stuff that allows me to do my own thing.
How difficult is he to manage?
Luckily, I don't have to deal with that. But, I mean, it's been fantastic having Justin on board. And I think his experience adds a lot to the team, his experience on the continent and beyond. Just to add to what he's saying, I think what Travis did a phenomenal job at was, it's probably a stretch to call Uber a startup today. But if you go around our offices and, you know, you may not feel this way in, say, our San Fran office, but in our smaller offices around the world, each office is like its own startup. And the team, we've got a cultural value about being owners, not renters. Like, you're passionate about the business. You're doing everything that you can to see your own business succeed. And as leaders within the business, you're really empowered to make decisions and build a business and, importantly, localize a global business to challenges that you're facing on the ground. Yes, Uber does solve global problems, and there are commonalities across all cities, but at the same time, it is important that we've got teams on the ground in the cities where we operate. We're identifying unique challenges, and we're building solutions to cater for those local challenges.
Yeah, I think this is an amazing point for your listeners too, right? So Elon makes an incredible point here. Uber, we're now over 15,000 employees. Yet the culture in the business bestows a massive degree of trust in its regional leaders. you know, even down to the lowest levels, we have experts sitting here, youngsters, that are empowered to solve problems that are meaningful to drivers and riders. And I think there's something really special in that. How do you create a culture at a startup level that allows you to think you're still a startup at 15,000 people? And, you know, all credit to Travis, that he's been able to propagate, and I must say, another gentleman called Emil Michael, these two were the progenitors of a very, very high degree trust workforce all around the world. Something super special in that. It'd be a great business case at some point, I'm sure.
Great. Well, I want to come back and talk a bit more about that when we talk about Uber's culture, but let's talk a bit more about the creation of Uber in South Africa and then in the SSA region. Elon, take us through the timeline of Uber's developments in the region. Take us through the trials and tribulations of building a technology startup at pace across a vast region.
Yeah, so sure. I mean, it feels like a lifetime ago, that the early days 4 years ago, and where we initially started off. And to just build a bit more context around that launch strategy, when Uber launched, this was the model back in the day. Mm. When Uber launched in a new city, we had a team of launchers who had probably had the coolest title for any job, being international launcher. And these individuals would go around to a new city, first of all, scope the city. Is it a go or is it a no-go? Very high level. And it's not a super complex business case to come to that decision. Do we think there's a large enough addressable market to answer that question? We'll look at things like population size, obviously GDP per capita, smartphone penetration, social media stats, etc.
Even roads, right?
Even roads.
Road quality.
Exactly. Infrastructure, traffic conditions, those sorts of things. What does the supply side look like? Are there vehicles available from a regulatory perspective that will help us build a business? Because obviously we have that marketplace dynamic. And if those boxes are ticked, then there's a go-ahead to launch in the city. So if we go back to my experience, I think I had my final interview on a Thursday. I was still interviewed by Travis and by Ryan Graves, who was the COO at the time. And I think the day before that, the first cars were on the road in South Africa. And the day after my interview, I received the offer. Uber started off with an Uber Black product at that stage, being the premium product. Mm. And if you actually look at the pricing for Uber Black when we launched, it was more expensive than the rates that we're at today. Because the way that we used to calculate our pricing strategy at that point was, what is the alternative product, being the taxi product in the city? We're now bringing a more premium product to the city, so it should be priced at a premium to that existing product. So it was quite an expensive product. I think your minimum fare was 85 rand. So if you're going a short distance, not very economical to move around the city. And really, in those early stages, the team were working out of a guest house. Was really, a lot of the focus was around, how do we get existing transport operators who have the right type of vehicles, being those premium like C classes or 3 series, onto our platform. And that was a lot of the focus. It wasn't glamorous work by any means. It was just a lot about getting your hands dirty. When Uber launches in a city, it's a small team. So it starts off with a general manager, marketing manager, and operations manager. That model has changed slightly today. But the theory back then was, marketing is focused on getting riders to download the RiderSide app to mm-hmm. request trips. The drive operations manager was focused on getting supply on the road, so growing the number of vehicles, the number of drivers using our technology, and very focused on the analytical side, ensuring that our marketplace is as healthy as possible. And then the general manager, obviously working closely both on the marketing and operations side, and getting more involved with things like regulatory engagement, media engagement, and general strategy of the business. But the early days were really about another cultural value, is really always be hustling. And it's not about, what Travis used to say, is that it's not about making lemonade from lemons. It's about making lemonade from thin air. And people, I think, often think that making lemonade from thin air is about glamorous things, and it's not. It's about hard work. It's about, you know, we're spending time talking drivers through how to use application. But I think it was different to the experience in the US, where most drivers who we were partnering with had a smartphone, were familiar mm-hmm. with apps, etc. But in some cases, drivers were using the smartphone for the first time. So it was really about taking that step back. How do you use a touch screen? How do you use Google Maps? Getting the supply on the road, really being focused on the customer experience. We used to do all customer support ourselves. So again, the theory back then was that if I'm selling you the product and you have a bad customer experience, then I'm going to be the one dealing with that bad customer experience. So spent a lot of time dealing with customer support issues on both the rider and the driver side. From that guest house, after a while, they got a little bit grumpy with us, I guess rightly so. We managed to, borrow some office space from a small little private equity fund that I was working with before Uber, and then a startup based out of Sandton. And then we moved into our own first office space, which was in Sinosteel Plaza. And we had about 100 square meters space or so. No furniture in those early days. It was just really a glass room. Very hot, actually. aircon wasn't the most effective in the building. And the room, which we kept for about a year post, that was separated. There was no structure in between other than a photo wall that said Uber, where on one side we'd have desks, and on the other side we'd do customer support for drivers and driver onboarding and driver training. So it was really, those early days was about like keeping, the lights on and keeping the business running. We launched the low-cost product, being the UberX product, in May of 2014 in Cape Town, and followed that with the launch in Joburg around August. And UberX is really the product that transformed the business in South Africa. Uber Black was a fantastic product, and I think what's interesting is that it created this aspirational element to Uber, where people saw it as this fancy way to get from point A to point B. And people would often say that, you know, it was so amazing, I got dropped off at this event I was going to, and people started taking pictures of me getting out of the vehicle because they thought I was a celebrity getting dropped off in a Mercedes or BMW. So I think it served its purpose, and the product's still healthy and exists today. But the product that really scales, and the product that, to Justin's point, changes cities, is the low-cost product, which now you've got a minimum fare of 20 Rand. If you share a ride, it is quite economical to move around the city. And I do believe in South Africa, we're providing an alternative to car ownership. One of the stats that we have is that in the month of September, there were over 25,000 people who took Uber more than 10 times a month. Hmm. So it just gives you a sense that people are actually using Uber as an alternative to car ownership. Obviously, I'm a little bit biased, but between me and my wife, we've got one car, and I Uber to and from work every day. It's productive time that I have in that vehicle. I can make phone calls, I can check emails. And we're hearing this from a lot of people because for the first time in our cities in South Africa, and I believe this rings true across the continent, you have an alternative to car ownership. You know that no matter where you are in the city, you can get that vehicle in 5 minutes or less. And it is a little bit chicken and egg because you can't promise you can't get people to download the application, request a ride if the supply is not there. But once you reach a point where the product becomes more reliable and your wait times reduce from 20 minutes to 10 minutes to 5 minutes or less, it does become a game changer for cities.
I want to add one thing because Alon made a really good point around unlocking transport in cities. And look, it may be lost on some people, but your telco nerds, and I know you had a big telco following, one of my San Francisco colleagues talked about, like packet switch networks. You've got packet switch transport. And this is how you get massive economies of scale. If you think about car ownership is as analog or serial transmission, ATM transmission. And then all of a sudden you're TCP/IP. I know I'm getting a bit carried away here, but it really is that. And that's how you unlock the scale. Massive efficiencies in that. And it's an interesting way to think about it because if you kind of get your head around that, it really is transformative for the city. It changes the way in which people interact with the city. It connects them to economic and entertainment opportunities that just frankly weren't there because of the cost of transport.
Mm. And so, I think there's often this misconception, do these lower fares not mean lower earnings for driver partners? And this is a question that we often get. And a lot of those existing operators who we were chatting to at that guest house in Joburg when we launched 4 years ago, thankfully I can say, are still partners today. And part of the reason is because the economics make sense, that despite the average fare for trips are being lower than they were before Uber launched, the overall earnings are higher because drivers are spending less time waiting between trips. They're not driving 10 kilometers to a pickup location for a short trip. It's usually, I mean, a 5 minute or less journey. So we're talking 1-2 kilometers tops to get to the pickup location. And they're spending more of each hour on a trip, meaning their overall earnings, despite higher operating costs, are healthier than they were before.
I wanted to ask, just before we leave the topic, the expansion elsewhere in sub-Saharan Africa. It must have become a lot easier since launching in Joburg. I mean, you must have almost packagized the model. And do you just drop teams on the ground, parachute people in, roll it out quickly? Or is it still quite a lot of manual work that's required on the ground every time you go into a city?
Yeah, so look, I mean, again, it hasn't been a switch. Like, I wish it happened quicker. Mm. But I think at the stage when we launched both Nigeria and Kenya, it was still very much a siloed approach to our launch strategy, where we'd go in with the launch team and launch the market. And to be honest, it did serve a purpose. I think our launch team did a phenomenal job. And again, going to Justin's point on case studies, I think there's going to be a case study in how Uber managed to get something which is very much real world to so many cities in such a quick period of time. But it was relatively siloed, not necessarily leveraging best practice from other cities. But when it came to, so that would have rung true for Nigeria and Kenya. We started with a regional mindset, probably for the first time in about May of 2015, where we stopped thinking about things at a country level or a city level, but more on a sub-Saharan Africa level at that point in time. And then there was increased knowledge sharing. And there's always been a great culture of knowledge sharing at Uber across all countries, regardless of where you're based, but was really formalized as a structure in May of 2015. But if we look at our launches last year, that was very much a team coming from the region that was going in, leveraging central processes, central teams from within sub-Saharan Africa to launch. So I think the model improved over time. And if we look at our launch last week in Kumasi, it was almost done in the ordinary course of business with no dedicated launch team. We have set up a Greenlight Hub being our customer support office for driver partners, but a lot of the heavy lifting, a lot of the technical back end was all done out of Joburg. Mm-hmm. Yet we still retain that mindset of having a local team on the ground, interacting with driver partners on a daily basis. And there is that, importantly, that feedback loop to understand what those issues are. Feed them into a central team and improve the process continuously. And it is a work in progress. I don't think whether it's structure, whether it's launch strategy or business strategy, it's never that we say, you know, we're done now and it's perfected. I think it's a continuous cycle where we're always looking to improve upon the way that we do things and make it more efficient, automate more processes, and really just run a leaner and better business.
Justin, you head up business development for the region. Is there a particular market that you're particularly excited about? And what is the ultimate opportunity, in your view, for Uber across Africa?
Yeah, so at the moment, I'm spending a lot of time in Lagos doing some development around structural supply issues. You know, the Nigerian macroeconomics have been super tough, currency depreciation, increasing import duties on cars. So the context is very difficult. It's got 22 million people in the city, though, so the opportunity is no doubt there. And so I'm talking to a lot of banks and vehicle suppliers in the sense of being able to get secondhand cars, insurance companies to try and cover the risks. There's a whole bunch of stuff that we are working on that's different to other markets in Africa. I mean, people who work in Africa know that Africa is not just Africa. You know, it's a whole bunch of countries with very distinct and different issues. But Nigeria is fascinating. I love it. It's got some big challenges, but most of my time there is spent on trying to do deals that enhance and are accretive to our supply. Nairobi is also incredible. I love that city. It's an incredible city. We're doing some stuff there on supply and demand. There's a public, it's public deal with Visa that we've done across sub-Saharan Africa. Visa are funding the sixth ride free. Now, that's kind of interesting because it's, you know, Visa's clients are banks, not necessarily individuals who have the card. It's kind of a strange relationship. But they understand that this Uber use case, this ability to put a card in an app and press a button and get a ride, is so significant, even in low-carded markets, that they've done this partnership with us. Incredibly exciting. So we've got Visa that kind of does demand, and we're doing that in Nigeria and Kenya. It'll be in South Africa soon. And then on the supply side in Nairobi, we've done a fantastic deal, which is also public, with Stanbic there, that essentially lowers the cost of car ownership for our driver partners, which allows them to be their own entrepreneurs and their own bosses as opposed to working for fleet partners. Two distinct models, both are very good for us and our supply, but it's kind of cool if you can do deals that allow people to get into their own business or their own cars at an affordable rate. You know, it's easy to do it at a punitive rate. And so that's a large part of my job is trying to do that on the supply. Demand is about what we call partner-funded rides. So how can a brand partner with us and give rides to its customers? And the thing that's super interesting about Uber that is not often obvious is that if a brand gives people rides, we put the brand in that experience. And the key word there is experience. It becomes an experiential activity and marketing event for the brand. So it can bring a brand to life in many ways. Retention is quite big. So customer retention for a bank or for a telco or for a brand, they can reward their customers for loyalty in the form of rides. A very simple mechanic. It's not complicated, but it's visceral. You feel it. And so, you know, I think there's a good mix there on the demand side. People are getting these experiential, visceral branded experiences, in addition to just paying for rides that are quite economically good. And then on the supply side, trying to do deals that allow drivers to have their own businesses in large part, and allow fleet owners also to be able to create a business, a significant supply through drivers. So it's kind of layered. And then in South Africa, we're focusing, you know, on the demand side mostly. There's been some fantastic deals done on the driver's side here already by people who had the role previously. That's kind of what we do.
And in terms of the opportunity in Africa, I know you're focusing on the main markets. Is there an opportunity down the line to go into some of the smaller markets as well?
Yeah, so look, definitely. I think globally, the business looks at the existing cities where we operate, and they're pleasantly surprised. I think, as I mentioned, we launched South Africa, but I don't think people expected South Africa to be as big of a deal in the global context as it is today. And I think that rings true for other cities across the continent, and the potential's there. I mean, Pierre Dimitri, who heads up our operations for EMEA, always says that, you know, he talks about 2 billion people in EMEA, but 1 billion of those people are on the continent. And yes, there are challenges operating in some of our African cities. I mean, for example, and this is completely operational, we've had really heavy rains in Nigeria and Lagos over the last few months in the rainy season. And roads are not fantastic at the best of times. And it makes matters a little bit more complicated when you have bad roads that are now flooded, where, one, people don't necessarily want to take their cars out on the road because they might get damaged. And secondly, if the car is on the road, it's just taking a lot longer than it should to get where it needs to be. And these are local challenges which, you know, you've got to operate around and you've got to build a business around. And as Justin says, not every city is the same, but a lot of these challenges, a lot of these learnings we can apply to other markets. I think for the moment, we're definitely focused on unlocking the value and the potential out of our existing cities. Justin mentions, I mean, Lagos is a 22 million person population, huge opportunity there. And the business is doing well, it's growing. But in terms of potential market opportunity and size of the business, there's still a long way to go. So we do believe there's value in focus and getting things right in the cities and countries where we operate. But do I believe there's potential for growth and expansion beyond the countries where we're in today? Most definitely. And that's definitely something which we're considering and something which is on the cards going into 2018.
Okay. One of the other points I wanted to quickly make is that Uber increasingly appears to be a great extension of public transport. So where public transport might have a capital investment gap for a period of time, we can fill that, but also the last mile, bringing, you know, like tributaries into the main channels of public transport, we seem to be very good there as well. And so countries like Nigeria, there's an opportunity for us to engage with public transport companies there and make that experience a bit better.
Yeah, I think just to add to that, 2 points. One, like, I mean, if you have to think about the investment required from a government, from like regulators, if they want to get reliable transport to people in a city, let's say in an average time of 5 minutes or less, that's going to cost a substantial chunk of money, and it's going to take a lot of time to develop that infrastructure. But through technology, leveraging this network of entrepreneurs around the city, you've got this ability to get access to transport in a very, very reliable period of time. And I think to Justin's point, it's just really the beginning of the opportunity. Right now, the product provides an alternative to car ownership. But we're always thinking about what next. Is there an opportunity in a city like Kampala to launch a product around boda-bodas, around motorbikes? Is there an opportunity in Nairobi to think about, like a matatu, a minibus type product in that market, which is fixed route with people hopping on and hopping off? And it is important that we do develop solutions that are localized and that cater to multimodal options of transport that exist in our cities.
That's an interesting one, because very often you see big Silicon Valley companies imposing their model on emerging markets, and certainly you've seen that with smartphone companies, for example. Perhaps Apple is a good example. Their products are designed for people who live in a market where there's abundant access to Wi-Fi, but you transplant that into an economy where people are really dependent on mobile networks for access, and it doesn't really work.
Well, this is one of the, again, another takeaway for the business minds that listen to your program. There's something, like, I think one of the key differentials between Uber and the other Silicon Valley giants is this ability to bestow a high degree of trust in these young business people around the world. And so, I think it's almost a dichotomy, but Uber is very good at playbooking stuff. We're very good at sharing IP, but at the same time, we bestow a high degree of trust into the city. And so, I mean, if you're looking at R&D and innovation, this is a very, very interesting model. It's hyper-fluid. It's got the right amount, on average, of shared IP through playbooks, but then also the right amount of trust. Like, you know, look, there's no doubt we don't get everything right, but on average, this is very, very successful. I think it could be, you know, a model for the future. And I think Uber's the only one that's really doing it at the moment out of Silicon Valley. And I particularly like that trait about Uber, because it's not this, you know, echo chamber that Silicon Valley is all right all the time. There is a lot of input coming into our HQ.
Let's move on a bit, and I think it's perhaps allied to what you spoke about earlier, Justin, and the entrepreneurship and giving people the opportunity to take risks and that sort of thing. Alan, there's been a lot of lot written about Uber's culture in recent times, and there's been enormous upheaval at the top and lots of hard questions asked about corporate culture. We're at the southern tip of Africa. What has your experience been, first of all, of the corporate culture at Uber, and to what extent have you guys been able to build something that has a separate identity or culture to the mothership?
So I think Justin's touched on a couple of these points. I think one thing that Uber's done exceptionally well is give local leadership teams, local offices, the ability to form their own identity. And I think we got 14 cultural values, so it's quite a lot. And I think you can, in some cases, interpret all these values Travis was really the brains behind those 14 cultural values. And all of those values came from a good place. And I think what you've seen in most offices actually around the world is people have embraced the good aspects of the culture. A good example is meritocracy and toe-stepping, where there is a culture of being able to question someone. So if I disagree with Justin, I'm not going to go behind his back and speak to his manager and speak badly about him. If I'm going to disagree with him, I'm going to do it in front of him. And that goes with the saying that, like, you can do that without being a jerk. Let's just have an honest and transparent conversation. I think where things have potentially gone wrong with some of these cultural values is that people forget about the good and maybe take things a little bit too far and are a little bit too fierce in their approach. Mm-hmm. Thankfully, I can say that my experience at Uber has been a positive one. And I do believe we've got a positive culture in the region. Obviously, some of the behaviors, some of the stories that you hear out of San Francisco are horrible and should never have been tolerated and should never have happened in the first place. But the positive that I take away from this is that there's really been a lot of self-reflection for everyone within the business, for the leadership team in the business. And there is definitely a mindset that that sort of behavior will not be tolerated. And that's not what Uber's about. Uber is about those good things, right? Uber's about being humble, where I think in the past we've come across as this brash, arrogant company. And that's really not what the company's about. And part of the reason why I'm so excited for Dara to be joining, I think if you've heard him speak, he is just extremely authentic, extremely humble. Obviously, super successful, has built a tremendous business, but at the same time is still humble, is still authentic, approachable, and also, I guess, comfortable and confident enough to be vulnerable. And I think those are the traits that we need to see. And those are things which I think have also existed at Uber continuously, but unfortunately have been drowned out by some of the louder characters, which may represent some of those negatives that you hear and are associated with the brand.
Yeah, I think it's three things, at the risk of getting in trouble with some people, but from my personal point of view, I think Dara's brought some authenticity. So what he's done early doors is own some of our missteps. You know, we apologize for that behavior. We're going to get better. I love that. I'm super excited about that. The second thing is, when you're in a startup, and this is almost a meta point about startups, when you're in a startup, there is so much going against you that you do get into this siege mentality, that this kind of in the trenches mentality, and you become a little bit belligerent. And quite frankly, sometimes you have to ignore some truths, because if you listen to them, you're going to get so desperate or depressed, you're going to close shop. So that sometimes forms a modus operandi where you are a bit belligerent. And quite frankly, when Uber and Travis started out, if we had listened to some of those people, there would be no Uber. So the modus became one, well, let's question some of these givens in society. And, you know, I think that debate was, it's a city-by-city basis, but I think there was this culture built. And quite frankly, the culture was good at the start because it was opening up cheaper transport for everyday citizens. You know, there's an argument to say that the taxi medallion model is probably a little bit dated. And then the third thing I'll say is that Uber is incredibly good at change. So I've been in the business a year ago, and I already saw changes in the business, the humbling, the increased focus on diversity. I saw that as I was coming into the organization. What we probably didn't do the best job of is telling the world about that. And again, that's one of Uber's cultural traits, in that we just head down trying to get stuff done. Uber has become so important that we actually failed at that. We should have been telling the world that, hey, we're doing these things and we're getting better at it. So this change has been happening, but in the last 6 months, the change and the transformation of the culture across 15,000 people has been remarkable. So I think we're in a good position to respond really well to this. We can see a lot of it happening across the globe, acknowledging some of the missteps and wanting to be better. There is, at the core, we want to do good and be the best at it. Sometimes that doesn't translate, but the ability to change will hopefully get us on the right track. I'm a big believer in that.
Many people refer, when they talk about companies like Uber and Airbnb and others, they refer to the word, they use the word disruptive or disruption. To what extent do you think a lot of the pushback and agitation towards... You disagree with that Uber's disruptive?
Yeah, I think disruption is... Well, firstly, it's overused and it gets confusing and everyone's a disruptor. I firmly believe... And I'm a big believer in the disruptive, positive ability of technology. But I think it understates it. My view on Uber is... It augments with civil society. It augments with current technology. So, you know, some of the there's a philosophy where, you know, bits and atoms come together and it's transformative. My view is that, you know, the so-called disruptive technology becomes it augments with existing industry. So I see it not just Uber as well. I see Amazon bringing the bits to a lot of verticals that are the atoms and enhancing and getting scale, better customer service. You know, this is what business is about. You know, over time, cheaper costs with better services. That's what Amazon does. And Amazon's bringing it to a whole bunch of verticals. It does displace some jobs. But, you know, when I have these conversations, there's a lot of case studies that show that technology is actually enhancing, right? So, you know, when ATMs were brought out something like 20 years ago, or 30 years ago, everyone thought the bank teller job would not exist. Well, if you look at the data over 10 years past ATM introductions, the growth in bank teller rates increased because people were transacting with their banks more. Banks were able to sell more services. And it offloaded some of this transactional banking into the ATM. And I think you see a lot of this. You know, the conversations around AI and robotics are also in this space too. Obviously, there's concerns about jobs, and obviously, people often need to gain new skills. And so as a civil society, we need to build structures that allow people to get new skills more easily. And then we go on to education. There's a, you know, there's this hegemony in education that essentially, you know, bestows qualifications for big amounts of money. But let's not go down that rabbit hole. So coming back to this disruption thing, my view is disruption has taken on too many negative connotations. It connotates that it destroys. But I don't think, you know, the Ubers and the Airbnbs and the Amazons do that. I think over time, from a societal point of view, they're accretive. And we see it in our data. When we go to cities, we see economics being unlocked. We see economic opportunities being created. We see, you know, greater incomes. And so, you know, I guess maybe it's a semantic point, but there's this Silicon Valley ethos that we are going to disrupt and destroy industries. And it's just not the case. You look at the data, it's just not the case. So that's my view.
I think it's just really a mindset of questioning the status quo. So, you know, just because things have been operating in a certain way, whether that's external to our business or internal, is it the best way? And that's really the mindset. And I think it's a mindset versus anything else. And I think that's what's enabled the business to be successful, because there's always been a mindset that there should be a limited number of vehicles available in a city, because that's better for vehicle owners. But what that actually means, if you look at New York City as an example, and Justin touched on that medallion system, what was happening was you just created value in a medallion where that was not owned by the driver of the vehicle, that was owned by a small number of individuals who traded these assets, and they were assets worth close to $1 million each. and they rented out these assets where the medallion gave the driver the right to operate in a particular area for a couple of $1,000 every week. So what that meant for the driver was that he or she needed to start off the week with the giant hole that they needed to get themselves out of because they had to pay back that medallion owner. Mm. And then on the rider side, you were, yes, there are a fortune of yellow cabs in New York City, but during rush hour, if you try to get a yellow cab there, it's actually quite difficult. It meant that in Manhattan, and let's exclude Manhattan, if you look outside of the core Manhattan area, it was actually quite difficult to get a ride when you needed it. And we questioned that. Is that the best way? Is that really best for riders and drivers? And we don't believe that's the case because we believe the more accessible you can make it to more people, the more drivers can benefit. The more affordable transport is for riders, and the more, to Justin's point, the more individuals benefit from this overall ecosystem.
Yeah, I just want to also make this clear. I'm maybe being a drama bitch here, and I think it's probably a good debate we should have maybe at Gibbs or something, because I think disruption is a distraction. You know, Lon hit on this. It's using technology to think about how to do things differently. And if we look at kind of the dawn of the industrial age and capitalism, I think very early on in the 1900s, there's a guy, an economist called Joseph Schumpeter, who mm-hmm. talked about creative destruction. So creative destruction has been happening. What the internet does is allows this creative destruction to happen a bit quicker. And what he meant by creative destruction was actually not destroying industry or destroying jobs. It was very firmly accretive. We would do things more differently, and that would unlock more economic value and the value of the firm.
Through efficiency.
Exactly. And I think the internet technologies have done this, right? It's very clear that scale and ability to service customers is much better. You know, I think if you look at Bezos is a great example. Fundamental core attributes, right? The first one is customer obsession. Mm-hmm. So he uses the internet to do what businesses have been doing since day dot. How can I make that customer experience better and deliver cheaper prices? You know, this is not new. And so I think we have a little bit of an echo chamber that talks about disruption. I think there's a meta point. It's a great discussion because that's distracting. The reality is, how can we continue to think about doing things differently and better using technology? The other thing I'll say is that Bezos is very good at putting technology at the core of his business and not having it, oh, I've got this internet part of my business. That's a very key lesson for entrepreneurs, innovators, and also people running listed companies.
And I think another aspect of that is the data aspect, right? Where, again, data is core to every single thing that we do. It's not saying which is an afterthought. It's core to every single business decision. And I think we're lucky in that the business is 7 years old globally and it was built from the ground up, so we can measure everything. And we're constantly holding ourselves accountable to metrics and to targets that in a lot of cases we can actually measure in real time. And that's unique, and that's not what an ordinary business can do. And I don't think, is that disruption, I think potentially, I don't know what we call it, but I think it's just a different mindset to building a business, ensuring that you can hold yourself accountable. You can bring that customer obsessed mindset to an industry which is globally not renowned for customer service levels because there is now accountability because of data, and we can now measure relationships in essence and measure customer service on both the rider and the driver side. And that was something which was not really ever contemplated a couple of years ago.
And that certainly led to friction. I mean, you are in some respects challenging, challenging the old way of doing things. How does Uber better manage the friction with regulators in particular, but also with the metered taxi industry? We've seen incidents of appalling violence in South Africa between metered taxi drivers and Uber drivers. What's in your view, can be done better from an Uber perspective to manage both of those, communities, the regulators and the metered taxi drivers?
So I think this I mean, this goes to a point which has been made, right? That have we been perfect? No, we haven't. Could we have done a better job? Yes, we could have. I think it really, we did try to engage with existing industry operators. I think we probably did a better job at it in Cape Town than we did in Joburg, where a large number of the original UberX partners in Cape Town come from the meter taxi industry. We did try and engage in Joburg, but I think we potentially gave up a little bit too easily in terms of convincing the vast majority of meter taxi operators in those early days to partner with us, and also to dispel some of the misperceptions that existed about the brand. But it's not like we've given up on that. Mm-hmm. And I think something we lose sight of with all the unfortunate intimidation that's going on is that there are actually quite a large number of existing meter taxi operators who make use of our technology in Johannesburg. And some of these operators are operating in a completely new way, in that they don't have traditional business waiting outside a hotel or a Gautrain station, but some continue to operate in the way that they did before Uber launched. And when they are not busy, rather than just being reliant on foot traffic, they log onto the application, and all of a sudden that world of prospective customers increases because of the benefits that technology brings. So I think, what can we do better and what are we focused on doing? We want to engage more. We truly don't believe that it's about Uber or taxi. We believe it's Uber and taxi, and both can coexist. We believe that it definitely shouldn't be an either or. This is an and situation. I believe it's accretive. I believe that it's not taking away existing jobs from existing operators. If you speak to individuals who use Uber on an occasional and regular basis, a lot of these individuals did not make use of meter taxis regularly, and in most cases, if at all. Mm-hmm. Yet, people are now making use of Uber on a regular basis because a lot of those concerns that they had around the industry, whether it was warranted or not, around safety, around cost, are now addressed through technology. So we believe that there is an opportunity here for more operators to benefit. It's not about making the pie, cutting it up into smaller pieces. How can we make the pie bigger for more operators? And a lot of that, I think, is on to the point in storytelling, around communicating, around dispelling the misinformation. So we're committed to doing that. When it comes to regulators, I think, again, there's definitely a perception that we're cowboys and we hate regulation. Something which I think we've tried to be honest about is that if 4 years ago we would have gone to regulators and said, listen, it takes quite a while to get an operating license in Joburg for someone who's looking to partner with us. Is there anything that we can do to expedite that process? And then taken a step back and waited for these licenses to get issued, we wouldn't have created over 10,000 economic opportunities in South Africa. So what we've done is we've been engaging with regulators, we continue to engage, we've been pretty transparent that there is a backlog in the issuance and operating licenses, but individuals go through all requisite steps to apply for their operating license, they pay the necessary fees. And what is regulation trying to achieve? It's trying to make transport, in this case, safer, right? So how do we address that, right? We believe that technology introduces traceability and trackability that previously did not exist. We address that by ensuring there's a blanket insurance policy for any ride that's booked using our technology. So you don't need to worry about, is this vehicle insured or not? All vehicles go through roadworthy checks, third-party vehicle inspections, drivers go through additional criminal background checks. So we're not compromising on safety. We are trying to work with regulators around, again, like, you know, another thing what we like to say is that regulation is lagging innovation. And this is not a case unique to South Africa. I think this is something that we see globally, where the current regulation does not quite cater for smartphone technologies. But where regulators have said that, and there is an amendment to the NLTA which caters for an e-hailing category.
Sorry, NLTA?
National Land Transport Act.
Okay.
Which will create like e-hailing, so allowing for smartphone applications like Uber. But right now, we're not letting that lag impact on the ability to move forward. But importantly, we're doing so, we believe, in a responsible manner. And again, I think we don't claim to have all the answers. We want to engage with regulators. We want to listen. We don't want to just talk. I think in the past, again, we've probably been a little bit too brash and come across as not willing to listen to the other side. And that's not the case. We want to hear from various stakeholders and ensure that we can create a win-win scenario. We're not against regulation. We're just for smart regulation.
I want to add two other points. One is, you know, there's this sometimes this misperception that Uber doesn't care about this stuff. We have a large senior team that addresses this almost on a daily basis. In fact, pretty much on a daily basis. It takes a lot of our time. We care deeply about this aspect. We have two phenomenal people in Yulisa and Morsa who run our policy, an incredible legal director in the form of Bob K. Hira. These people spend a huge amount of their job trying to solve these problems as far as regulation goes. Regulation's hard to change, right? You need white papers, you need promulgation, and so that's why regulation often lags innovation. We spend a lot of time trying to help regulators build the policies and the laws that can get regulation to catch up. And the other thing I'll say too, so there's a huge investment there. And the other thing I'll say too is there's a massive investment from us on safety. We worry, like a lot of us don't get much sleep when these episodes occur. The challenge is we're not the police force. We can't preemptively stop anything. And so it pains us, but these are the constraints by which we are governed, and they're civil society constraints. You know, these are not something that is transport specific, but there is a lot of care, a lot of love, a lot of invested time and money going into solving this problem. We have to.
Just last question on this subject, because I know we're a tech podcast, not a focusing on this sort of stuff.
Well, it's interesting, this bend between regulation and tech. It's super interesting. Yes. Well, not interesting for everybody, but it's really important.
Sure. Just a last question, though, on the violence we've seen involving the meter taxis. Are the police doing enough? I know Uber has gone on record to say that more arrests need to be made in this regard.
So we're encouraged by the progress that has been made. I think there is more focus that's being given at the highest levels. We are seeing an increased presence at the key hotspots, being some of the Gautrain stations, from the police. So we're definitely moving forward. Do I believe that I'd like to see more arrests? Yes. I don't think this is necessarily an issue which is Uber specific, but I can say that I do believe that the police are doing what they can and will hopefully be doing more over coming weeks and coming months.
Great. Let's move on and talk. Let's get back to technology and talk about where it's going, where Uber's going. You've launched the Uber Eats food delivery service in South Africa just I think last week or the week before. You launched the Uber Movement website in Johannesburg, which provides detailed information about traffic patterns. And Uber Pool is also available in South Africa, is that right?
Not yet.
Okay. I know you also had a team here with driver vehicles fitted with cameras and other sensors. What was that all about? Can we expect a service like Google Street View, or is it more meant for internal use?
Yeah, look, I'll let Alon speak to most of that. I know that there is a significant amount of money allocated to our mapping technology across the world. It is incredibly important for us, especially for Africa, where we have been underserved with mapping technology, and it does cause some issues with GPS tracking and geofencing. So that's what I can talk to. The other one is we're spending a lot of time doing significant mapping partnerships, so the business development team globally are trying to augment some significant partnerships. So you'll see, and this is public information, you'll see our, in fact, in San Francisco, we have this program called Visa Local Offers. Mm-hmm. And essentially what that's doing is taking points of interest in San Francisco, so local operators, local commerce, and appending value as you do your trip. So if you opt into it and you go past a restaurant, you might get a voucher, 50% off if you eat here, or, you know, buy this and get something off. Look, it's a trial stage. The numbers coming out of it are super interesting. And so maybe there's a future in that, layering points of interest inside the trip experience. There's also trip experience content inside, you know, the app that we've also looked at publicly. We've got a Snapchat partnership. And, you know, for the younger types, the millennials, you know, that's super cool. The numbers have been great. So that's the mapping stuff. And I think the cars that were in country or in region were trying to add data to that mapping initiative.
And that mapping is really about the pickup experience. I'm sure, unfortunately, often when I chat to people, it'll be like, I love Uber, but I have this issue with my pickup. And the intention is really to build maps that are purpose-built with the Uber experience in mind. So where is the optimal pickup point to reduce wait time for drivers, to reduce walking time to the pickup location for riders, all those sorts of things. And hopefully we'll have some more announcements around mapping coming out next year. When it comes to Uber Movement, I think Uber Movement is a great example of hopefully our new approach to regulators. And that's one of engagement where we've had a partnership with the CSIR around Uber Movement, where they've vetted the data, where they've looked at the data, they've helped us really localize the data to Gauteng. And we made the announcement last week where now anyone, as long as you've got an Uber profile, and it doesn't have to actually be an active Uber profile, can log on to the Uber Movement website and download that data and then manipulate it and use it for whatever the purpose is. And we hope that this data proves useful when it comes to longer term city planning. What are the throughways across the city that are more congested than others? And it's also not a product which is launched and is now static. We're reliant on feedback from users. What information would they like to see? And how can we better improve the data that's available and that experience that's available to better suit the needs? And hopefully it's something we can launch in other cities.
And I love, this is what makes me passionate about Uber. Uber Movement is not an economic play for us. This is a way in which we can take extremely valuable data and we can give it to the cities that we're in. Now, if you think about this data, we know the high traffic routes. All of a sudden, you can start town planning. You can also put public transport in the routes that we're heavily trafficked in. And we love that. We think, you know, part of our future is augmenting with public transport. This data is, you know, if you had to commission it, would cost cities tens of millions of dollars per city, and we're giving that free. Because we want our cities to be better. One of our cultural values is celebrating cities. We want Uber to make cities better. You know, again, I'm getting passionate about it, but it's, if you think about it, you can also plan parks. You can plan the way in which the ingress and egress points of people going into buildings. And you can design a city that makes people happier. I mean, that's literally what this could do. I mean, you were talking 10 and 2 decades out, perhaps, but that's transformational.
Well, while we're talking transformational stuff, and as we move to wrap up the podcast, let's talk a little bit about some of the exciting stuff that's coming out of the US. I know you've been doing a lot of research in the area of self-driving cars. Maybe talk us through sort of longer-term picture. Where is Uber going? What is Uber's long-term plan? I know you've touched on this a little bit, Justin, but will it always define itself as a technology company? Will it always be in the broader transportation market? Or is it something much bigger down the line?
So maybe I can start this one off, sure, and then hand over to Justin. I think a lot of this is linked again, and I'm quoting a lot of our cultural values, but I think something which Travis really epitomized was this cultural value of big, bold bets, which is thinking about what is the business going to look like in 5 and 10 years' time? What is that next big opportunity for us? Because if we're not thinking about it, if we're not working towards that future, there is going to be someone else that is working towards that future. So driverless cars being probably the poster child of this, sure, example, right? Driverless cars, whether Uber likes it or not, are going to be a reality in the US in a couple of years' time. And a couple could mean anything from probably 3 years to 10 years. But it will be a reality. And it's always controversial. Does that not mean that Uber does not care about driver partners? Because that means that driver partners or human-driven transport will be a thing of the past. And to the point around ATMs and bank tellers, we don't believe that that's going to happen. We believe that the future world is going to be a combination of human-driven and autonomous vehicles, where you've got a human-driven network that complements that autonomous network. That autonomous network is probably going to be the biggest, and I'm going to use the word that Justin hates, disruption in modern times, in the impacts that it's going to have across a multitude of industries, but ultimately in a very positive way, making economies far more efficient, reducing congestion, reducing carbon emissions, and importantly, reducing human error accidents and saving millions of lives over time. So that is an exciting opportunity. And as I said, rather than watch other companies define that future, we want to be part of the driving force behind it. And again, touching on a point that's been raised, this is not saying it's going to happen overnight. And what if we can see this coming, if we can be part of the change, how can you equip those that are potentially impacted with new skills? So if this happens, there is another opportunity for them. It doesn't mean that their previous job may become or may evolve or may become obsolete in an absolute worst case, but it's not going to happen overnight. How can they prepare for that ultimate change? So I think it really comes down to that vision, that mindset of what is the future going to look like and how can we be part of it? Because if we're not thinking that way, there are going to be startups or companies that are thinking that way and are going to disrupt the way that things that we do things. So we always do need to be thinking about the future, because if we're not, then I don't think there's a future to the business.
So I think one of the key statements here, it's not either or, it's not binary. And I'll never forget when I was in San Francisco and Travis was talking quite openly that, you know, when we look at the modeling of self-driving, we expect the driver population today to be a factor of what it is when autonomous becomes mainstream. So in other words, the population of driver partners today won't shrink. It's going to increase by factorial as autonomous comes in. The second point is frontier markets and autonomous, super, super hard to do. You need very, very good mapping. And there's also technology that allows you to enhance GPS by bouncing certain signals off buildings. So you go from a 30-meter radius to 3-meter radius. And that precision is very important in self-driving, right? Mm-hmm. This is a universal fact. But I will say, so Uber's just hit its, and this is public too, just done a million miles of self-driving, 30,000 trips, which puts it, you know, as one of the leaders of self-driving, just behind Waymo and Google's self-driving business. It's something you have to do if you want to be in transport. And you'll see all the OEMs now investing in self-driving in one way or another, or in a technology called LiDAR, mm-hmm. which is the laser or the light radar, which captures millions of data points per second, ingests them, runs a rule set against them to self-drive, and then throws them up in the cloud, uses machine learning, and then self-teaches every single car almost in real time. And that's how it gets super safe, because every error or mistake is learned by every other car. So just from a safety point of view, you know, the tragedy that comes from vehicle accidents, if we can take that out, the population of driver partners is still going to increase. And I think in frontier markets, we're still going to need the labor input, and autonomous is not coming to frontier markets anytime soon because of mapping. I think this is a good news story for the planet.
Well, I'm, for one, I'm certainly looking forward to the first autonomous Uber being on the streets of Johannesburg. I'm guessing it's a few years out there. Elon Lips is GM for Sub-Saharan Africa at Uber, and Justin Spratt is head of business development in the same region for Uber. Gentlemen, thank you so much for joining us on the Tech Central podcast today.
Thank you, Duncan.
Fascinating. Thanks very much.
Thank you. Best.